This is an interview with Molly Schauffler. Today is February 10th, 2014, and this is Adam Chilli conducting the interview. So I'm wondering if you can tell me, how did you become attracted to studying climate?
I came back as a graduate student in 1990. I'd been out of school for a long time, and I actually came back to study botany. That was my undergraduate degree. And so I worked with, I started out with Krista Schwinzer over in Deering Hall, looking at Miracle Gale. And as I, that fall, I took a class with George Jacobson, the ecology class, required graduate course.
This was 1990?
This was 1990.
Okay.
And in that class, I got talking with George on our various field trips, and he kept asking me what I was interested in, and I said I was interested in why plants grew where they grew. And as we talked, he convinced me that studying Miracle Gale probably wasn't going to meet my interest so much as maybe I could look at bogs. And so we just talked about possible research projects that involved plants, but not so much about nitrogen fixation. So I switched advisors and worked with George, and that, so this was for a master's degree, and that was not so much with the Climate Change Institute, although I did a study of road salt invasion in Alton Bog up here on Highway 95, and worked as much with Steve Norton on that as I did with George, and so in a way had two co-advisors for that project. But got to know George and got to know the Pollen Lab and had an office over there. And so that's how I got interested in working in climate change for a PhD.
Which you did right after your master's?
So I hadn't planned to work on a PhD, but I did. When that finished, George had found some money, and we worked with Acadia National Park and the Roke Island Eastern Maine Conservancy and who else? The Nature Conservancy. And I looked at pollen records in small forested hollows on some of these coastal sites and up in Big Reed Preserve. And that was.
Did you take cores?
Yes. I took small hollow cores, forested hollows. So it's about a meter of peat sediment in these forested hollows. And that gives a pollen record that's much more localized than a lake or the ocean sediment. Well, ocean sediments wouldn't be pollen. But I was interested in the changes in the local forest and when spruce appeared in Maine, and so that showed up in these small forested hollows. Sorry about this cough. I have a little bit of asthma, and it's a cough variant.
That's all right. So this record is more localized. Is that because the core you took was perhaps a bit more shallow than?
It's because the cores are in forests. So if you core a lake, the sediment record is, it's depending on the size of the lake, collects from a wider area since it's open. So pollen blows in from hundreds of square kilometers.
I see, okay.
But in a forest, 50% of the pollen comes from the local forest itself. So you can actually get a signal for what kind of trees were growing at that location for the as long as the core goes back.
And how far back was that?
Well, core? Some of them, they're all different. So I took some on Isla Ho, two cores from Isla Ho, and those weren't as old as the core, for example, from Blackwoods Campground in, or near Blackwoods Campground in Acadia. So that core, the Isla Ho cores were 2,000 or 3,000 years old. Excuse me. And the Blackwoods core was over 10,000 years old. So it went all the way back to the last glaciation. The Roke Island core was also was 9,000 or 10,000 years old, I think.
Yeah. Tell me about the methods you use to analyze those cores.
So I was joked because as much as I like to be outdoors, I would get to be outdoors for maybe 2 days in the field looking for the cores. You have to be able to find a place deep enough with undisturbed sediment. Mm-hmm. And then collecting the cores, and that all took no more than 2 days in the field, but then it would be 6 months of analysis in the lab. Mm. So you essentially chop up the core into little half centimeter or centimeter increments, sample from each increment, and one analysis is to isolate the pollen from the core, which means processing it with very harsh chemicals. And that gets rid of all of the organics and mm-hmm. crud that's in there. Besides the pollen, itself is very durable. It's one of the most resistant substances. So after processing it with acids and various compounds, you end up with pretty much just the pollen and spores and things like that.
Microscopic
yep.
pollen.
Yep.
So actual like 10,000-year-old pollen mm-hmm. that you were looking at.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
It is. It was a wonderful study. The other analysis is going down through the core and sieving it through very fine meshes and then sorting through what you get to find charcoal, bits of charcoal, and also bits of plant material that you can use to date the core. So I was looking for little pieces of wood or pieces of well-preserved leaf that I could send off for a radiocarbon date.
To where do you send them?
Those went out to Beta Analytic, which I forget even where. I think it was in Arizona, and that's a lab. We have to pay for the samples, and
we can't.
We don't.
You don't have those.
We didn't have that here. I don't know if they. I don't think they do radiocarbon dating here, but maybe they mm-hmm. do now.
Yeah.
But at that time, they didn't.
I see.
And so that was part of the expense of the research, was paying for those samples.
So what did your research tell you?
It was a pretty fun story. My question was essentially, how is it that where did spruce grow since the last glacier? Because when we look at lake pollen from all over Maine, and those are collecting from wide collection basins, so hundreds of square kilometers, mm-hmm. and in every one of those cores, it it looks like the modern amounts of spruce and fir pollen, didn't really come into Maine until about 250 to 500 years ago. So really very recently that Maine was so covered with spruce fir forests.
Huh.
And yet when spruce pollen appears in these stratigraphies, it comes very quickly. So all of a sudden, there's lots of spruce here. And my question was, how could it have come so quickly? It must have been here in small populations, isolated, for it to all of a sudden, the climate improved and mm-hmm. spruce could establish
could
itself
thrive.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
So my question was, where was it growing? And my hypothesis was it was probably growing along the Gulf, along the coast, where the cooler temperatures, cooler and moister climate, as opposed to inland where it's a little bit warmer and drier. And spruce is very vulnerable at the seedling stage. I don't know if you've ever pulled up a little spruce seedling, but it's got just a single thin taproot that goes down, and it will stay in the forest that way for many decades before it'll survive that way until a tree blows down and a gap opens up, and then that seedling can grow. And that's why these forests perpetuate themselves so nicely. But to do that, it really requires enough cool enough and moist enough habitat for it to be able to survive as a seedling. So my thinking was that it would have could have survived along the coast more likely than in populations inland. So I tested that by having five sites along the coast, two on Idaho, one in Blackwoods on Acadia, on Mount Desert Island, one at Skudik Peninsula, and one at Roke Island, which is even farther east. So I had you could think of it as a transect going down east. And then I had two sites way inland up at Big Reed Preserve. And the thought was that I should see pollen stratigraphies with much older spruce on the coastal sites, but I should see the ones on the inland sites coming in recently, like 500 or so years ago. And that's pretty much what I saw. It was quite interesting because the farther east I went, the longer the spruce had been there, which fits climatically because as you go east, today there's 50% more fog at Eastport than there is at Bar Harbor, so it's just naturally a gradient for moisture and coolness. So it sort of showed that the last 10,000 years, the climate has shifted in Maine, and because Maine is a ecological transition zone, we're right at the edge of the range for spruce and fir, for the spruce fir forest. And so just that little shift in climate, a little bit of warming during the Holocene, was enough to drive spruce into these small refugia. And then as it actually started to cool a little bit before the industrial, before this recent warming, spruce was able to come back in and spread more. So it's kind of a neat story of how responsive spruce fir forests are to the kinds of changes that have happened in Maine over the last 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating. So what did you do after completing your PhD?
Well, I was much more interested in working with teachers and in science education than actually continuing on with research. So I had a postdoc. I actually had two postdocs after I finished. One was another paleoecological study, and that was working in Acadia National Park with a much bigger project, the PrimeNet project, which was looking at mercury in Acadia National Park. Mm-hmm. And the question was, the big question was, why are some watersheds in Maine high in mercury and some low? So you can get fish out of a lake in Maine, and we didn't have a real good handle on why the fish in this lake would have high mercury. There would be soluble mercury available to fish in the food chain in this lake, but not in this lake. So this was looking at the effect of the 1947 forest fire that happened on Mount Desert Island. And if we look at the history of two watersheds, one in the fire and one not in the fire, is mercury being processed differently in those two watersheds? Is there mercury in one and not in the other? And can we explain that by the forest fire? And my job was to actually do take the sediment core from each watershed and look at the fire history. So it was mainly looking at charcoal and then looking at the pollen stratigraphy to see if indeed these particular watersheds burned and how the vegetation changed when it did burn. So that was a one-year project. And then I got a second postdoc fellowship with the National Science Foundation, and this was completely different. It was working with science teachers and finding out what does it take for science teachers to get their students out into their communities measuring and monitoring things as part of their science learning. So essentially using real monitoring, environmental monitoring, as a way for teaching science education. And that was a two-year postdoc, I think, with NSF. Mm-hmm. And then from that, that was about the time when the Center for Research in STEM Education formed here at the University of Maine. Mm-hmm. And so I joined that center and developed a course for teachers about helping them learn the skills of doing research, which many teachers never never actually did research themselves.
Yeah.
And so, and I still teach that course every other fall.
For designed specifically for teacher candidates or people that are already teaching?
Both. So the RISE Center, the Center for Research in STEM Education, has a Master's of Science in Teaching program. We have about 20 or 30 graduate students who, it's a thesis graduate program. And so they take the course, but also it's open to practicing teachers, and I always have a few, one or two practicing teachers in the course at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's been a fun class because it's really about environmental monitoring and how can we do this in schools and with kids, and mm-hmm. what are the pedagogical considerations to doing environmental monitoring, and how is it done by the big agencies, and how do you use the data, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, did you become a member of the Institute upon completing your PhD?
How did that work? I think when I had my, at some point, I guess when I started teaching the class, I needed to affiliate with a department. Mm-hmm. And so, because Steve Norton was my mentor for the NSF postdoc, that was his department. So I joined the Department of Earth and Climate, the School of Earth and Climate Sciences. It was geology department at that time. Mm-hmm. And then I joined the Climate Change Institute because, again, a lot of my work was, the environmental monitoring is related to climate change. And mm-hmm. having had my degree in the Climate Change Institute, it just seemed like a natural fit. And the people I worked with were in it. And so that was, and a lot of the environmental monitoring was tied to climate change. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it just sort of seemed like a natural
natural
affiliation.
Fit.
Yeah.
So you were around then when the Institute's name changed to the Climate Change mm-hmm. Institute. What did you think about that?
It seemed to make sense. I think, I work a lot with people not affiliated with the university at all. A lot of my interactions with teachers and with communities is not the university community, and everybody struggled with the quaternary, so it was a lot easier name for people to process, and seemed like a good adaptation to changing times, and made sense. Mm-hmm.
How do you think the Institute's changed since you first became involved with it?
Wow. I think that Paul has really done a lot to put the Institute out there in a much bigger way than it ever was before. Mm-hmm. I think the Quaternary Institute was certainly prominent in its field, in the field of quaternary research, and Hal and George were great leaders at that time, and I think it was a good idea to bring Paul in when he came, because he has, of course, a much bigger picture, I think, in terms of, and then climate science exploded and just became much more in the public eye and of much greater public interest. So I think it's just been an evolution that's come with the times, and it seems much more connected to the bigger research world now than it was before. Mm-hmm. But then my time before was more as a graduate student, not so much as a faculty person. So. Mm-hmm. I can see much more of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I understand also that the size of the Institute grew enormously since Paul Majewski came.
I think so. I think there are a lot more people who are involved, whether they're directly involved in, the day-to-day or affiliated in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it can only be a good thing, just because it's inclusive, and But I must say, personally, at the moment, I'm pretty much on the periphery because I don't do climate research right now. Mm-hmm. The environmental monitoring is really with the education goal and the pedagogical, you know, that whole purpose more than it's science education, not so much outreach about climate.
I see.
Do you see the difference? Mm-hmm. Outreach about climate would be more, here's what the Institute does, and here are what our labs are like, and here's the kind of research we do, and this is what we're finding out. But mm-hmm. the education purpose that I pursue is much more about, these kids have got to learn certain parts about science, and mm-hmm. For example, one project I'm working on now is about data literacy, and it turns out that students and teachers don't have a real strong that just reading graphs and speaking the language of data is not a strength for many high school and middle school students, even though it's on there, you know, it's what they need to learn. So I've been working a lot with on a project helping middle school and high school teachers figure out how do you teach students to really work with graphs and tell the story of data. And I try to use a lot of climate data to teach about that, but mm-hmm. many kinds of data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the techniques you've learned to help make high school students better able to use the tools of scientists?
It's got to be meaningful to them. That's the bottom line. And it's one of the things that both makes climate, it's an asset about teaching about climate. Climate is usually something that students can get. They've heard about it. They see how it relates to them. But at the same time, I think for a while there's been an overdose of everything's been climate change, and it's numbed a lot of students out. Mm-hmm. So for us, in the data literacy project, a bottom line for us is to work with real data sets. And so if, for example, the Climate Reanalyzer, which Sean Burkle has created, if we can get students looking at that and asking questions about that kind of data, if we can get students looking at temperature data from various parts of the state, even from their own town, mm-hmm. students do relate to and respond to that kind of learning. But it's harder to get them to get excited about data if it's something they just doesn't mean anything to them.
Right.
So the climate stuff is a pretty good hook for students.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, it's good for high school students, but many middle school students, a lot of it's pretty abstract. So it's hard to talk, for example, about a pollen core mm-hmm. with middle school students because it's hard for them. They're just beginning to be abstract in their thinking, and they don't really, unless you take them out in the woods with a core and get the core and look at it and talk about how old parts of it are, as far as giving a slideshow, it would go right over their heads.
Mm-hmm. How long do you, do you plan on working with teachers down the line?
I think so. That's kind of what I do now, and I have a lot of connections with teachers, and I like keeping those alive. They need all the help they can get to really, there's just a lot on their shoulders for teaching to the standards and to the tests, and so any enrichment or sort of added real genuine science connections they can make, the better.
Do you see standardized tests? And here I'm referring to the No Child Left Behind Act.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as a problem or an obstacle to teaching authentic scientific inquiry?
Absolutely. With this data literacy project, we have developed a bunch of kind of practice data sets and, you know, real questions that students can investigate with real data sets, and teachers love them, but they do say, you know, I just don't have time for this because we've got to cover the stuff for the kneecaps or whatever test they're preparing for. So it does, and they have so much on their plate that they have to teach. The ironic thing is that looking at data, for example, I could pull together a graph of an ice core data, the Delta 018 or whatever kind of data it is that, that we might be able to say something about an ice core. And the teacher will look at that and say, ah, that's great, that's really interesting, but my students have to learn about predator-prey and, you know, so then I think, okay, I've got to come up with data sets that relate to predator-prey data. Mm-hmm. And that's the work that I do, is try to find data that relates to what those teachers have to teach about. And climate is working its way into the standards and into the curriculum, but it's all changing so fast that it's very difficult for the curricula to keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
One question I like to ask is, you know, within the scientific community, there's no longer really any debate about human role in climate change. But outside of the scientific community, it's still something that's continuously debated. And I'm wondering if you can maybe speculate as to why that is the case.
I hear it from teachers all the time that they have students who don't acknowledge, you know, it's not happening. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty clear that that happens when that they get that from their parents. Mm-hmm. And so I think those ideas persist because it's perceived as a political issue rather than a scientific one, and those political views are, you know, for various reasons, get ever more polarized. And so I think they're very hard to change. People don't always perceive science as being a way to look at this stuff. And they don't, they think the scientists are working for political parties or whatever. There's just a lot of mistrust. But that's why my work with data is so, to me, it's very important, because if you can help students see data as evidence and think of what evidence is, that's the hope. But I think these views just persist because of the way they're presented in the media, and if the media feels it has to be, quote, objective, it will go find the one person in the crowd that is the climate skeptic and interview them and treat them as an equal to the scientist that's making a statement. And so then the perception is that there's 50% for and 50% against. It doesn't. So it, I think the media often perpetuates this kind of thing. But apparently, Hurricane Sandy changed a lot. Viewpoint. After Hurricane Sandy, there was many more people thought that climate change was a real thing.
What do you think has been the Climate Change Institute's most important contribution to our understanding of science?
To our understanding of science?
I'm sorry, of climate.
Of climate.
Yeah.
I think the work... I mean, that's a very big question and could be taken on many scales. I think I'll think of three contributions. One is at the state level. I think the climate report that George and Ivan and the committee pulled together for Baldacci a few years ago, it's more than a few years ago now, I think that was a huge contribution to the state.
Maine's Climate Future.
Yeah, yeah. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of it.
Yeah. This.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was written in terms that I think most people could understand, and it kind of went through. It's a survey of what the Institute and others have, what the data say about how things are changing in Maine. So that plus then the follow-on to that was Maine's, I've forgotten what it's called, but it's about climate adaptation in Maine. And that's still, that committee's still active and is still focusing on so what do we need to do to adapt to climate change? And that's much more where this science is now, I think, is about adaptation in terms of the public consumption for policy and so forth. It's really, people are being concerned about that. But so that, I think this suite of contributions at the state level in terms of reaching out to policy was a huge contribution. Scientifically, I would say probably the work with abrupt climate change has been a big sort of global scale contribution. I can just think of so many things that people are doing. There's a lot with the climate modeling that has been a huge contribution. I guess I'm pretty hard-pressed for specifics because I don't track a lot of the other research projects so much. I think, there was one other contribution I was going to speak of. I think that the training of graduate students here is a huge contribution. It's not all of them necessarily go on in climate research, I guess speaking for myself, but I just really value my graduate education in the Climate Change Institute, just in terms of preparing me as a educator and as a scientist, no longer really practicing in research, but I do research in education research, but it's not the same kind of research.
Right. Well, that's all the questions I have, but before concluding the interview, I did want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't think to ask you about.
I think a big question for the Climate Change Institute, and so this is sort of with this anniversary coming up, it's always a good time to ask where are we headed, or what are we doing that we could do more of, or better, or differently, and what I would really like to see is. Well, I think this has improved a lot, is the Climate Change Institute's involvement with policy and with the people of Maine. And I think there are a lot of people who've never really heard of the Climate Change Institute here. Mm-hmm. And I know Paul has been doing a lot to try to remedy that. And I don't know what more necessarily could be done. But I think it's been a huge resource for the state of Maine and a largely unknown one. So, the whole idea of adapting is really a pretty big issue and is going to be for the state. And I always love to see bridges between the scientific community and the people of Maine, because that's why we're here.
Yeah.
And fulfilling that land grant mission is really central to me. And so I think that's a really important contribution that we could always do better at.
True. Okay, well, thank you for participating in this interview.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming and for you asked great questions, and it's very interesting to see what you come up with for So will this be written up in some way, or mostly just archived?
Yes, Paulina and I are planning on writing a paper.
Yeah, good.
Maybe by the summertime we'll have something.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
Good, good. So. Wow, thank you for doing this. Mm-hmm. And you should get a copy of this if you don't have one.
Yeah, I was going to actually stop by the office and see if they had extras.
I think they do. I think they do. And the other one to ask for is, and I don't have a hard copy of it here.